Think you know the Brooks Ghost? Think again. Introducing the all-new, better-than-ever Ghost 16. Now with nitrogen-infused cushioning for lightweight, supreme softness that feels good every step, every street, every single day. So go ahead, take your daily joyride in the all-new nitrogen-infused Ghost 16. It'll turn your everyday miles into everyday endorphins. Let's run there. Head to brooksrunning.com to learn more.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game, but because we are recording this on Sunday afternoon, can't tell you whether Gareth Southgate of Crystal Palace has brought joy to the nation or Gareth Southgate of Aston Villa has let his country down. I'm Kevin Day and he's Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. Kieran, we're taking a two-week break from today and I'm hoping that will be long enough for my victory hangover to pass.
Well, I hope so. The Baroness has managed to get one step ahead of you because yesterday, which will be Saturday here, she went out to Ginfest, which was an outdoor gin festival, and I had to collect her late evening, and it was a traumatic journey home, and all the doors are locked between where I'm recording and the bedroom where she is still got a wet towel over her head. Oh, Lord. And saying she's never going to drink again.
Yeah, I've been there. I thought for one moment you said gym fest then, but then I realised who we were talking about here. But well, I wish her well for me. The wet towel helps a little bit. It's not. It's Questions Day, Kieran, although we do have one news story, but by way of a change, we will do that at the end. So I'm sorry, Derby fans, you'll just have to wait. If it is about Derby, of course, it could be about Sheffield Wednesday. It's about both of them. So they'll both have to wait. And for some reason, we thought we'd deliberately leave it to the end to create some suspense over the two-week break. I'm sure they'll be delighted with us for that. So our first question, Kieran, comes from Ewan Phipps. Ewan Phipps is an Aberdeen fan concerned on various fronts, but mainly about the strange transfer movements of Ronald Hernandez. Now, Aberdeen signed him in 2020 for £800,000, which was their second highest transfer fee. And at the same time, the club announced a strategic partnership with Atlanta United in the MLS. Now he's been loaned out to Atlanta with no apparent option to buy and no loan fee, it seems. And it looks like Atlanta loaned Aberdeen the money to acquire Hernandez in the first place with a view to Aberdeen developing him, then later selling him to the MLS club. Can you shed any light?
This does seem a very weird transfer. Ronald Hernandez was recruited from Norway by Aberdeen. And as Ewan said, second highest ever fee. So a lot of intrigue when he arrived. He's from Venezuela, I believe. Venezuela, an absolutely amazing country. I went backpacking in Venezuela in the late 80s and I hired a car and got lost. So I stopped outside an official looking building to ask directions as I've been going to, you know, pidgin Spanish at night school. And I was just sort of, you know, mentally, you go in your head, please, can you tell me to the nearest hotel? And by the time I'd thought through the words, there was a rifle stuck through the window because apparently I'd parked outside a military hospital and the local insurgents had a habit of car bombing. So I had to do the dumb Englishman routine, you know, point to my England football shirt, which I happened to be wearing at the time. But it was one of the scariest moments of my life. Amazing country. Anyway,
Can I just say, Kieran, you never cease to amaze me. You know that. Was this the same trip to South America where you encountered the otter?
The giant river otters in the Manu National Reserve. Yes, it was. Yes, okay. It was. I decided to do as much of South America as I could. Amazing continent. Thoroughly recommended. Fantastic people. And amazing river otters, of course.
Yeah, the fantastic people, apart from the ones sticking rifles through your car window. Anyway, Ronald could have been Ronald Hernandez's dad, for all we know.
Could have been, absolutely. So they signed him from Norway on, I think it was on the 31st of January. So Norway had just come out of their winter break. So he arrived not match fit, played about two or three games, never lasted more than an hour because he wasn't match fit. And then they Aberdeen lent, effectively loaned him out to Atalanta. That didn't work out. He wasn't getting gameplay there. And everybody's scratching their heads because he's he does look a decent player, but you then of course had to factor COVID into the equation. I think originally the intention was for his family or wife to come across and stay with him. So he's in the Granite City, which it's a pretty bleak place. Aberdeen in winter, you throw COVID in, so therefore he's effectively locked into a single room, can't see his family, and unsurprisingly, we're dealing with a young man, and I think he genuinely struggled. And what then happened, which was very strange, was that Atlanta appear to have loaned Aberdeen a right back to replace Hernandez, who is a right back. So that's where we are at present. Trying to get any more of it is I understand that he's actually now back at Aberdeen. He's still got 3 years left on a contract, so that's going to be quite pricey for him. And the manager doesn't fancy him, but he did score in the Copa America a couple of weeks ago. So I've been watching that because it's opportunity to nerd out on football, of course. So that's all that we know, but it does seem that the relationship between Aberdeen and Atlanta is strange in the sense that was it the Atlanta scouts who effectively recommended him to Aberdeen? And as for the funding, again, that seems strange that Atlanta, if they're lending the money to Aberdeen to buy the player. So can't dig any more into it because all we've got is public domain information, but... it does show that sometimes these entente cordiales between clubs aren't necessarily all that they are cracked up to be.
You signed a strategic partnership with Hibs, didn't you, recently?
Yes.
So it's a similar sort of deal, sharing players, sharing scouting information.
Yep. And I think, weirdly, we've just loaned a player to Hearts.
Right. Oh,
which seems very strange to me. But I think we've one of the Hibs players has now come down to do a bit of training, and I think what I understand is that the coaches are sort of having meetings where they're sharing ideas. So it's not necessarily going to be a player exchange. It is going to be an exchange of ideas, and we've also got a club in Belgium which is owned by the club owner. So there's rumours about us signing a player from Japan, but he doesn't qualify to play in England under the GBE rules. So put him into St. Gallois or whatever it is in Belgium with a hope that he'll pick up enough points there to then come across to England.
This notion, Kieran, that a club may lend another club money to buy a player that they eventually want, is that unusual, unprecedented, happening all the time?
It is strange. It does call into question to a certain extent. If these stories are true, and say we are just sort of operating here on an element of hearsay, does this constitute third party ownership?
Yeah.
Which would be frowned upon. But it's not common practice, that's for sure. And Aberdeen, as a club, are run pretty well financially. So I'm surprised that they would need to have borrowed the money in the first place.
Aberdeen's a great city, by the way, with a really thriving comedy scene. But we talk a lot, Kieran, about the sensibleness, if you like, for want of a better word, of Scottish football finances. And I think the fact that Aberdeen, who are one of the great teams in Scotland, that their second highest transfer fee is only £800,000, says volumes about the difference between the way English clubs finance themselves and the way Scottish clubs do, doesn't it?
Yes. I mean, if you take a look at the Scottish transfer market, I put together a spreadsheet, which will come as a surprise to you, and I think Rangers and Celtic between them were responsible for 93% of player signings over the past three seasons.
93%?
Yeah.
Well, of players or just of financial value?
Of all financial value.
Crikey, good Lord. What you need to do, Kieran, is put some kind of gin-related spreadsheet together. Sort of.
She came home with a bottle of mango-flavoured gin. And I'm going... you don't like mango. And she sort of, and she just smiled at me.
Yeah, but see, the trouble is, Kieran, as an experienced drinker myself, there reaches an hour in the evening when it doesn't matter whether you like mango or gin. If somebody's holding a bottle of mango flavored gin in front of you, I can't be doing with gin. It makes me maudlin, Kieran. It brings out the romantic Irishman in me. I start fighting my inner Cromwell. Tommaso Grant is a regular listener, and he has what I think is a very interesting question, which, of course, is not to imply that everybody else's questions aren't interesting. They are, of course. But Tommaso Grant says, in the lower leagues, you often have clubs with large followings who have fallen on hard times. With this in mind, how much does the value that a team derives from the Championship fluctuate depending on who's in that league with them? So, for example, if Wickham were in the Championship at the same time as Leeds, Blackburn, Sunderland, Norwich, Sheffield Wednesday, etc., could they expect to be noticeably better off than if those teams were in the divisions they would normally be in?
Yes, I think they would. If we take a look at sort of some of the smaller clubs, and it's not really possible to assess the impact on Wickham because they were so unfortunate that they were promoted in the COVID year. So the impact on attendances. So I went back into the records, and I think a really useful one is looking at Yeovil Town, because they reached the Championship, and they had one season in the Championship in 2013-14, and their attendances rose by over 50%. And the reason for that is that the away teams, and there were in that time there were so many decent sized teams in the Championship. We had Leeds, Derby, Forest, of course, lots of stalwarts, Sheffield Wednesday. I remember going there myself. And by the way, folks, if you are ever going to Yeovil, don't use the official car park, because it will take you 2 hours to get out of it at the end of the match. It's one exit only. But the away end at Yeovil, the capacity there is 2,100, and that was full practically every match. Also, for many clubs, what we like as fans, it's a new ground, so therefore you seize upon the opportunity to visit there as well. So yes, it does have an impact, and we've seen Wickham, we've seen Yeovil, and of course we've seen Burton Albion that they reached the Championship as well, and that had an impact. And it's not just in terms of the benefit for the club in terms of attendances; it's also on the town as a whole, because all of a sudden you've got 3,000 Villa fans, Derby, especially for Derby, Burton and Derby. And it's really good for the hospitality industry as well. So it certainly does make a difference. You will sell more season tickets, but it's the impact on the away fans. I know that our good friend Andy Holt was, at one stage last season, Accrington were in the playoff places, and he'd done some budgets on the difference, and it was very significant.
Oh, interesting. Stuart Capel asks, when desperate clubs splurge money on transfers in January, does that mean they tear up their budget and have less cash to spend the following season, or do clubs leave a contingency for emergency January spending?
A lot will depend upon the owner. Those clubs which are perhaps fan-owned, those clubs which aim to be self-sufficient, they might bring forward some spending, whereas other clubs who have owners who take the blank checkbook approach to player recruitment, they'll just allow you to effectively twist on 19. And sometimes you have to spend money on in January. You might have injuries, you might have players' loss of form, or you might have signed a player in the previous summer window who just turned out to not get on with the manager, or turned out to be that his YouTube showreel was perhaps a little bit elevating his actual talent. So it's a bit like a household budget. I started work on Friday at 5:30 in the morning on BBC One, talking about the economic impact of England winning the Euros, or at least appearing in the Euros, and people were saying, this is a massive boost to the economy. I said, well, it's not, because people will bring forward spending. So if we spend an absolute fortune on hospitality and barbecues and televisions this weekend, it means for the next month or two, people will be saying, well, I've only got so much in a salary each month. I've got to make ends meet. And also, if you spend more on X, you spend less on Y. So for those clubs fortunate enough to have sort of a sugar daddy style owner, it's not an issue. But for those clubs that run to a more tight budget, it's to a certain extent robbing Peter to pay Paul.
If it's anything like me, the morning after the semi-final win, there's been a massive boost to the paracetamol industry. that January question is a really interesting one for Palace fans, though, because when Allardyce took over, we bought four top-quality players who probably kept us up, including Milivojevic and Van Aanholt. We bought four in January, which was amazing because for two reasons. One, we didn't think we had any money because the club was telling us we didn't have any money, and suddenly we found money to buy four top-quality players. And two, it happened so quickly. Palace normally spin out their transfer dealings, and so it set a few alarm bells ringing as to why suddenly we could do this in January. And then, of course, the conspiracy theories start that Allardyce had been lined up a long time beforehand, but it's the only time we've done it, to be perfectly fair, although we have managed to buy a player in the summer, Kieran, before the new season starts, which is amazing for us.
Careful.
Triggered a release fee, even, Kieran, that grown-up thing from the Michael Elise tape from Reading. Phil Chater, who I presume is a Peterborough fan, but Phil Chater says, last season it was revealed that the ownership of Peterborough's ground, the Western Homes Stadium, I still can't get used to calling it.
It's London Road, Kevin.
It's London Road. It's London. It's simple. Yes. Anyway, the ownership of the stadium transferred from the local council to the club's owners, not the club itself. And Phil says, I'm uncomfortable with this, but can it work in the long term? And also, sometimes it's difficult to distinguish the club's owners from the club itself, isn't it, Kieran?
It is. London Road, and I've got very fond memories of it because when my dad was dying, he said he wanted to go to one home. He wasn't a football fan. He wanted to go one home match and one away match with me. And my mum drove him to Peterborough. I was living in Manchester at the time, so there was this poor old guy. He was starting to fade away. So it was 1985-86, and we went to Peterborough. It was one of those matches. It was an FA Cup fourth round match in the middle of winter, snow on the pitch. We drew 2-2. And I've still got that memory today. And when people say, you know, football grounds and memories, you know, what is it romantic and nostalgic? Well, it is because I've got that for the rest of my life. So I've got hugely fond memories of London Road myself. But the ground was sold by the council. So the council owned it for 10 years. They sold it and they gave the club a discount for, I think in inverted commas, its contribution to the local town and economy, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
And it's been sold to, ironically, London Road Peterborough Properties Limited, which is owned by the owners. And then I sort of did a bit more ferreting around. And the first thing these people appeared to have done is that in order for London Road Peterborough Properties Limited to buy the ground, they took out a mortgage with Old Kent Road Finance Limited, which has its registered office at London Road in Peterborough. So it's all very weird.
It's all very monopoly, Kieran, as well. At the moment.
Well, I got quite excited by that. I thought, this is quite funny because this being ironic in terms of a mortgage?
Yes.
Yeah. You know, so I thought, yeah, I quite like that. Peterborough have Darren McAnthony as one of the management team, and you know he's always entertaining, and I think he really does have an eye for players at that club. Yeah, their development model is absolutely fantastic. And there's a couple of other Canadian investors. But the aim at Peterborough is to move to a new multi-use stadium in an area called the Embankment. Now, if that happens, you can understand it from a financial point of view, because London Road, you know, built in the 1930s, is it really fit for purpose as a stadium which is going to generate money 360 days a year, as opposed to being open 20 to 25. So you can understand that. But if it is sold, then if it's, you know, and let's say that it's sold for property development, who then gets the profits? So you know, that could be an issue, and it could be that the owners are saying, well, any profits we're going to plow back into the club, and that'd be fantastic. But as we've always said before, you know, I know from You know, our experiences at Brighton when we used to play at the Goldstone Ground, the owners sold the club for £6 million to an unusual property company who immediately sold it for £21 million to somebody else. So you do get a little bit concerned. And also, if we take a look at what happened with West Ham and Upton Park, or the Bowling Ground, however people prefer to refer to it, it was sold by the club for £40 million and then immediately sold for £60 to somebody else. And so part of me says, well, that's a good deal. You know, if you sell it and you don't get a great price for it, and somebody flips it at a profit, you know, Dion Dublin would be absolutely delighted under those circumstances. So why should we criticise the new owners? But separation of club and ground in terms of ownership can make you a little bit uncomfortable. You know, that has been sort of a central theme of the podcast, and it's things which sort of, you know, we've discovered as fans from more and more clubs have highlighted this issue to us in the 172 episodes of the show.
Yeah. To explain the Dion Dublin reference to new listeners, because he's become a theme of the show as well. He is the co-host of a show called Homes Under the Hammer, which is about people buying houses and then selling them for profit. And he's constantly baffled by stairs every time he goes into a house. The fact that there are stairs, it's like he still hasn't quite worked out what this. There's always a staircase. It's always first thing he runs in. It's like the little girl at the end of its Miracle on 34th Street. He runs into the house and there's stairs. You can get up to the first floor. Bless him. Next question, Kieran, comes from Sam Barrett. Oh, I hope I pronounced that right. Barrett or Barrett. It's Brett with no in the middle, basically. But my question, says Sam, is related to gambling sponsorship in football. Pitching In is a company that seems to have been set up by Entain, the gambling group that contains Ladbrokes and Corals, and it sponsors the Isthmian, Southern and Northern Leagues. While it isn't directly linked to gambling, is there ever a point where gambling sponsorship can actually be good for football?
I think there can. I mean, you know, there is a degree of circumspection with regards to the gambling industry at present. And I think it's interesting that we now have this company called Entain, which is Ladbrokes Coral, and we've got Paddy Power, Betway and Skybet have changed their group name to Flutter. There does appear to be a desire to soften the name that, you know, the nature of the names that we associate with the gambling industry. Can it be a positive influence? Yes, it can. But is it good for football? Well, it could be. You know, why not have? And again, we've discussed this before. And I know when Gordon Brown called the show, he was talking about, you know, the impact of the gambling industry, and you know, we discussed having a football levy, because I was asked to do some calculations for a parliamentary group as to the impact of gambling in the economy. If we take the big four gambling companies together, their total revenues, total wages, are probably in the region of 210 to 220 billion pounds. And to give that some sort of context, football is worth around about 5.5. So the gambling industry is about 40 times as big as football. Could some more of that money flow through into football? Well, football is estimated to generate 40% of all bets. So I think, you know, the potential for, even if it's a, you know, a half a percent gambling levy on bets, could be really beneficial to the sport. It'd be really good for grassroots. The contribution made by Pitching In does actually appear to be one of the more positive ones, because it's not brand specific. It does appear to be the industry acknowledging responsibilities towards grassroots football. At the same time, you know, responsible gambling is good. There's still too much irresponsible behaviour from the gambling industry in the way that it markets itself. Certainly, if you've been on social media Over the course of the European Championships, the number of placed adverts is very, very high. We've got clearly the impact on TV advertising on ITV and so on. So yeah, my view is you've got to turn the dial down a bit, but football and gambling should coexist because it is part of the game indirectly. At the same time, I think the gambling industry needs to step up and acknowledge its responsibilities in a more responsible way.
I should point out that ex-Prime Minister Gordon Brown didn't call the show as such. The only reason he would have called me would have been to get your number, Kieran, to be perfectly honest. It was you he called. Our next question comes from, now I'm going to have to be careful with this name, because it comes from Big Dougie, or it could be Big Doogie. This is an issue for Palace fans, because our director of football, Doogie Freeman, doesn't like me calling him Doogie Freeman because he says his name's Dougie, not Doogie, which is the reason I keep calling him Doogie Freeman. One of the reasons I keep calling him Doogie Freeman. So Big Dougie, or Doogie, says, it was great to hear you touch on Huddersfield in a recent pod, which slightly worries me, Kieran, because as you know, we've got a massive backlog of questions. So that could have been a story about Herbert Chapman, basically. But Big Dougie Doogie says, I'm hoping you can provide more detail on the club's finances over the past 5 years, as it's currently causing consternation among the fan base. And now I can verify that, as I'm working with a young lad who's a Huddersfield fan, proper mad Huddersfield fan, who basically explaining how in the course of 5 years, they've had that euphoria of the Premier League for two seasons, and now there's nothing but worry about the money. And he says it's been very difficult for Huddersfield fans to find out any detail of the club's finances. Is that the case, Kieran?
Well, again, you are reliant upon what's come through officially in terms of the website, Companies House, looking at the accounts and so on. And I read it as Big Doogie, which immediately made me think of a Kevin Bridges routine, because that's who he'd normally be talking about. But back to Huddersfield. Huddersfield went from being a 10 or 12 million pound club in terms of revenues to a 120 million pounds club. So it was clearly a major transformation of their finances when they were promoted to the Premier League, and rightly so. Yeah, they were a cracking team that season.
They were.
Some of that money went on wages. So the wages went from £6,000 a week, and they were Huddersfield had one of the smaller budgets in the Championship. So again, incredible achievement, £6,000 a week to around about £30,000 a week when they were in the Premier League, and again, that was one of the smallest budgets. As a result of that, in their first year in the Premier League, they made quite a bit of money. In their second year, they made a little bit of money, and now they've been relegated to the Championship. They got the benefit of parachute payments, so they just about broke even, but they had to sell players in order to break even. So there is a downward slide in terms of their finances. Some of the things which have concerned me is that when you do look at the accounts in depth, there used to be loans from directors only, and now we've got loans from directors and loans from financial institutions. And it looks as if the loans from financial institutions appear to be factored, and by that, they are secured upon future parachute payments. Oh. So the club's borrowed money from a bank, and the bank says, well, thanks very much for that. We want your next three sets of parachute payments, which, of course, means that there is less money for the club to spend on players, which is clearly going to be the focus of fans. Then when it comes to the directors' loans, Huddersfield were sold a couple of years ago. The existing owner wasn't in great health. A new guy has come in. There are £34 million worth of interest-free, which is always good, interest-free director loans. But again, if you go into the back pages of the accounts, the club is scheduled to repay between £4 and £7 million of those loans each year, between 2022 and 25. And my first reaction is, well, you know, if Huddersfield, once the parachute payments have gone, if they're going to return to being a 10 to 12 million pound a year club in the Championship, and that's what we're hoping for, you know, sort of in a post-COVID world. Finding 4 to 7 million pounds each year to repay directors is going to be a challenge unless they've got a production line of players that they can sell. But you know, if you're having to sell players to repay loans, that has an impact upon what happens on the pitch. That drives down revenues because the fans get fed up. It increases the chances of relegation. And if you do get relegated, your TV money falls further. So I think they're in a challenging position. And it could be that the directors will say, oh, we're in a COVID environment now. We're going to kick back in terms of our loan repayment dates and push them further down the road to give the club further breathing space in terms of cash flow management. I would be concerned. No panic buttons, but you know, Huddersfield historically has been run pretty well. The new owners have put money in. But given a choice between putting money in the form of loans and putting it in the form of shares, I always prefer when it's in the form of shares because shares have no obligation to be repaid, and that is a critical difference.
Can I just check something you said there, Kieran? You talked about securing loans on future parachute payments, which surely they may not happen because if that is the case, I might go to NatWest and secure a loan on my possible three sold-out gigs at London Palladium in the next 2 weeks, which won't happen. But if you can secure loans on things that might happen, for them to get parachute payments, they have to get promoted and relegated again or relegated from the league they're in.
Well, no, these are the parachute payments following relegation from the Premier League in 2019.
Oh, the money they've already had, right.
That's right. Yeah. They took money out shortly after being relegated, and the bank says, well, you've got 3 years' worth of parachute payments. We're having some of that,
right? I see. I got you. Okay. I just thought I'd clarify that. Now,
when have you announced dates for your Palladium gigs? Was that the podcast show?
We might sell out the Palladium. That's what I'm going to tell my bank manager tomorrow. We're potentially going to sell out London Palladium for 6 nights. We've got some big guests coming in.
We'd have some very big guests. Yes.
Now, Smudge, if you would kindly get off the script, thank you. Move your tail as well, thank you.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
This is a familiar name, Benjamin Toews. But the new listeners, by the way, that's the cat I'm talking to. That's not my wife. she used to be prone to sitting on scripts. Benjamin Toast. That's, I don't know why I said that. It sounded much worse than it was. Very innocent comment. Benjamin Toast is a familiar name to pod listeners. And Benjamin's question is, says, Villa's owners aren't short of a few bob, which I believe is a technical accounting term. Can a subsidiary company of theirs simply pump money in by sponsoring the shirts for a silly amount of money if they wanted to increase transfer funds? He said, we bought our own ground, so can we effectively sponsor ourselves? And if yes, is there a point where the closeness of that relationship would make someone with a clipboard turn up, which is a pleasingly old-fashioned image, basically?
Yes, I mean, Benjamin is right to highlight this issue. This comes under sort of the umbrella heading of related party transactions. So as far as Villa are concerned, the two owners, Wes Edens and Naz Sawiris, are ridiculously wealthy. So right. they certainly have large amounts of bucks. In fact, Wes Edens was, I believe he's part of the consortium that just bought the supermarket chain Morrison's.
Ah, okay.
So, yeah, not short of a bob or two. He also owns the Milwaukee Bucks, which I believe are some sort of American franchise operation. The rules generally are is that if you own 20% or more of a business, then you have to disclose any transactions that you have with it. So that allows nerds like me to sort of work out, try to work out what's going on. And we have seen Everton, they have an agreement with a friend of the club owner. Alicia Usmanov, who has bought the option for not, he's not actually bought the naming rights, he's bought the option to have naming rights at the new stadium for £35 million. And that coincidentally came at a year when Everton's financial fair compliance was looking quite challenging. And also, I think he's helping to he's giving naming rights for the training ground and so on. So those deals can be done. But what the football authorities are now doing, and we saw this to a certain extent with UEFA and their charges in respect of Manchester City, is that we invoke what's called a fair value clause. So. If somebody comes in and says, I'm going to sponsor Villa's shirts at £100 million a year, and you go, well, hold on, your last deal was £8 million, and you sell 40,000 shirts a year. So, the numbers just don't seem to add up. So that they will try to say, well, we would normally expect a deal for a club of the calibre of Villa to be at a lower level. But these things are still taking place. So, for example, if we take Scunthorpe United, their naming rights have gone to a company which owns a Blackpool nightclub. Sadly, not Frenchies. my former memory erasing experience for £2 million. Yeah, that's a lot of money. Because how much. How much exposure are you getting in Scunthorpe to Cool Silk, this company which is involved in the Blackpool nightclub? And again, those are related parties because both are connected. Again, going back to our friend Andy Holt, his company Wham, they sponsor the ground and they do front of shirt sponsorship. There's nothing wrong with that. But what we do see is that the administrators within football, they will review the level of sponsorship from related parties just to make sure that the numbers involved are reasonable.
All right. Ben Andrew has one of those technical detailed questions that you like so much, Kieran. And I sometimes struggle to read. Ben says, my question is on player contracts when they are coming to the end of their deals. In England, if a player has 6 months left on his deal, he's allowed to start talking to other clubs outside of England in January for a possible I should have decided which one I was going to say before I started saying it, for a potential summer Bosman. What happens if he agrees a deal to another team in the EU, but then his original employer triggers an automatic one-year extension clause? Does the player or potential new club have any grounds to contest that?
Well, I think this is a case of who blinks first, or who blinks first, even.
Yeah.
If the player signs a pre-contract in February and the football club has not yet chosen to take up the option, it's too late. The football club could have taken up the option, for example, in October or November, but it chose not to. So what will happen is it will be a precedence which will be set on a chronological basis. If the club takes up the option, then the player cannot talk to other clubs come January. If the player does sign a pre-contract in January, then effectively it makes the option available to the club null and void.
Okay. Stuart Hatcher is another familiar name. I think Guy, producer Guy, seems to be front-loading this pod with familiar names. in an effort to make sure they come back after our two-week break. But Stuart Hatcher says, I'm not sure if this question has been specifically asked before. Now, nor am I, Stuart, but I'm going to give producer Guy the benefit of the doubt here because I'm sure his cold, dead-eyed laser efficiency wouldn't allow a question that's not been asked before, especially when we've got about 700 unanswered questions on a stockpile, which will be about 1,000 after we've had a two-week break. So it's a very efficient way of going about things. But, you know, he needs to count his money, as we've ascertained. Stuart Hatcher says, what is the average price of promotion from each league? Or in other words, how much should I be budgeting for a promotion season? And what does the trend look like?
Right. In answer to Stuart's question, at present, clubs are paying bonuses to players somewhere in the region of £10 to £15 million a year if they get promoted from the Championship to the Premier League. And I've taken a look at the losses of clubs who have been promoted. So by the time you factor in those bonuses and the fact that normally the club itself will have had to have invested in players in terms of the transfer market, the average losses for those clubs who have gone up from the Championship to the Premier League are in the region of £35 to £40 million in the year of promotion, which is a hell of a lot of money, and you're not going to get that back immediately. So it's a myth that promotion will solve a football club's financial challenges. If we then drop into League One, the losses there are in the region of around about £6 million for clubs in recent years. You know, again, pretty substantial, you know, over £100,000 a week. At League Two to League One is far lower, and the reason for that is the broadcast revenues. So the broadcast revenues increase between League Two and League One is probably in the region of, you know, £500,000 to £600,000. So, you know, that's the benefit to the club. It's worth around about £6 million going from League One to the Championship. And as we know, in getting promoted to the Premier League, we're talking potentially, you know, £110-120 million. As for the trend, I set up a spreadsheet this morning to go through this over the course of the last decade, and certainly the direction of the trend is northwards. The losses for clubs in the year of promotion are increasing, as is the investment that they've made in players in terms of both wages and transfer fees.
Okay, well, our penultimate question before our two-week break comes from Kieran Williams. And Kieran says, for teams like Man City, PSG and Madrid, why don't the owners buy, for want of a better word, a burner club like Paris FC or Bury and use that to buy players like Mbappe and either sell them straight away for next to nothing to the main club or just loan them to the main club? Would this not mean that FFP is saved as their outgoings would be hundreds of millions of pounds lighter?
Well, this conceptually could work, although I suspect that the buying club, so if we set up, you know, Bury City Limited, and they then signed Mbappe and loaned him for £1,000 to Manchester City, then people will say, well, hold on, let's take a look at now the finances of Bury City Limited. Yeah. This club is losing hundreds of millions of pounds in the Manchester Association Division 3. This is a sham, and what we will do is the equivalent of the veil of incorporation will be set aside, shall we say, and we'll look at the true substance of the transaction. Having said that, we do have things such as the City Football Group, and if we take the case of Aaron Moy, Australian player playing for Melbourne City, he was then signed by Manchester City for what appears to be a free transfer. He was then immediately loaned out to Huddersfield Town, and he was instrumental. He was absolutely fantastic for them in the season that they were promoted.
Stayed up,
and at the end of that season, Huddersfield Town bought Aaron Moy. So it was a loan which then became a purchase, and they bought him for a fee estimated to be in the region of £8 to £10 million. So City picked up a player for nothing, never played. I don't even think I've been on Google. I think I've even struggled to find a picture of Aaron Moy in a Manchester City shirt. Sure, yes. He effectively went from Melbourne City to the Etihad, never played a game for them. They got a loan fee for him in the first season. Then they got a transfer fee. We're talking in millions. And of course, that contributes towards Manchester City's financial fair play. There were broadly similar issues in terms of Frank Lampard as well, where he went to New York and then he turned up at the Etihad and people going, hold on, we thought that New York City had signed him. So there is the opportunity here, and none of this is illegal. Yeah, we have to stress this, you know, in terms of transfers of player registrations, but it does leave you scratching your head a little bit, and it's not dissimilar to the question that was raised by Benjamin Toast earlier on this podcast in terms of related party transfers of sponsorship rights. Well, can the same apply in terms of players? The answer is yes.
Mm. What I would do if I was the owner of Bury City, I would agree to buy Mbappe, and then I wouldn't sell him to Man City. I'd just say, no, you're not going.
And how would you pay his wages?
It's fictional, Kieran. I haven't gone down that line yet. I can't improvise. I haven't thought that far ahead. We do have a news story to come, Kieran. But our final question for now comes from John, just John, and John touches on a subject we have kind of touched on every now and again, but it's one that I think still intrigues people because John says I can see the benefits for the big sportswear manufacturers like Nike and Adidas of making the kits for big clubs. But Adidas also manufacture kits for teams like Hamilton Academicals, and Nike used to supply Southend. What is the thinking behind an association like that for the big manufacturers?
Well, from the manufacturer's point of view, ultimately, they're looking to sell units. Mm. And anything which increases the overall volume of merchandise they sell is potentially profitable. A Hamilton or Southend shirt will still retail for probably in the region of £40 to £50 million.
Yeah.
A bit overexcited there. And the markups in replica shirts, regardless of it's England or Manchester United or Liverpool, even dropping down to the likes of Southend and Hamilton, the markups on officially licensed merchandise are very, very high. So there is a benefit. And what tends to happen is that the smaller clubs will be given template shirts. So all that will happen is that you've got the template set up for season 21-22. You change the colorway, you change the badge, and you change the sponsor name, which is from a textiles point of view, is a relatively easy thing to do. You don't have to redesign the shirt because it's coming from a template. So you can knock them out very, very cheaply. Mm. You can also do that very, very quickly because they're being manufactured normally in factories in Asia, and it's actually very quick to actually change the colorway. And you could do in 2 hours, you could probably supply the whole of Hamilton's expected merchandise levels, and you're making a profit on the deal. So that's the benefit to the manufacturers. Yeah, if you've got dotted around the world 200 contracts on clubs who are selling 2,000 to 3,000 shirts a year, that's still 400,000 units of merchandise at a markup of, if a football shirt, even for the smaller clubs, let's say it costs 40, 45 quid, it's not costing you more than you're knocking them out for less than a tenner. Yeah. And I'm being generous there if I say
way,
a tenner. Yeah,
way less than a tenner.
Yeah. So, there's huge markups. The club gets a fee. The club gets some of the kit itself, of course, to display the wares, just as we did with Manscaped in the days when we were on good relations with them.
The glory days, yeah, of course.
So that's the benefit to the manufacturers. Lots of small deals are still beneficial.
Yeah, I still claim it's not our fault that Manscaped didn't research our audience well enough. basically tens of thousands of middle-aged men who have no intention of sculpting their pubes.
Speak for yourself.
Well, obviously, I wouldn't let the Baroness anywhere near them at the moment with scissors, Kieran.
No, true.
I said we had a news story. We've got two news stories because I want to mention something you brought to my attention, and that is win or lose, this group of young England players are clearly nice lads, aren't they, Kieran, with a social conscience?
Yes. Since, I think, around about 2007, England players have given their match fees to charities and credit to Gary Neville. I think he was at the forefront of this. It's fantastic. The match fees aren't huge. But in addition to that, should England win tonight, and hopefully people listen to the show will know one way or the other, the prize money is in the region of £26-27 million, and probably around about a third of that would go to players as bonuses.
Mm.
And it appears, and this is fantastic, is the England players have said, we're so proud, of what they brought the country together. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
On top of giving our match fees, we're going to give the prize money from the tournament to NHS charities.
Mm.
And you go, well, I've fallen in love with this group of lads over the past 3 or 4 weeks, and I love them even more. And this is fantastic. And yeah, people will say, well, they're wealthy enough already. Yes, they are, but they didn't. They've made a conscious decision to do this.
Yeah.
There's plenty of other wealthy people in the country who have made a lot of money over the course of the last 18 months who have not been giving it to NHS charities.
Yeah.
In fact, they've probably been doing exactly the opposite.
Yeah, well said, Kieran. Hear, hear. And when you say hopefully by the time this pod goes out, we'll know the result. We will definitely know the result by the time this pod goes out. Unless people are starting again and listening to every single episode, and then you never know. So, Kieran, the news story that we so cruelly teased Derby and Sheffield Wednesday fans with.
Yes. I think it's common knowledge. I have been critical of some of the football authorities in terms of lack of transparency and governance-related issues. Well, here, hat doffed to the EFL. They've now set up on their website a governance section, and what they are doing is, first of all, they are listing all of the clubs who are under an embargo. So you can now go to the EFL website and find that out. By all accounts, this came as a surprise to some of the clubs themselves, but the clubs knew they were under embargo. They just didn't know it was being broadcast.
Yeah.
So this is a step forwards, and I think it's appropriate. We are the biggest investors in the game as fans. We invest our lives in the teams that we love. So now the facts are out there, and the clubs can't weasel out of it. But on Friday they set up another page for judgments, and it now appears that Sheffield Wednesday have a suspended 6 points deduction. And Derby County have a suspended 3 points deduction on the back of failure to pay wages on time over the course of the last, 12 to 18 months. So if the clubs are late with wages, and I think I believe that Sheffield Wednesday's deduction will be halved if they get to the start of 2022. And do pay the wages, then these sanctions will automatically crystallise. So there's no flim flam. There's no weaseling out. The clubs know exactly where they are. We did mention the other day that Sheffield Wednesday had paid the shortfall of wages to players, and again, I will tell you after the show who's actually paid those wages. But fans will know as well. So, the clubs can't wriggle out and say, well, we didn't think it was going to happen to us. So the EFL has been up front. The fans know where they stand. The clubs know where they stand. In an ideal world, we don't want to see any points deductions. I'm completely opposed to what's happening in the boardroom impacting upon ultimately what, you know, in points on the pitch. But we are at that particular point.
You caused quite a debate, stir, whatever you want to say, on social media with the information that Sheffield Wednesday's wages may not have been entirely paid by the owner. And I know that legally we're not allowed to disclose who did pay them, but is it not incumbent on the club, in terms, as you say, in terms of transparency, to let people know how, who and why somebody else is involved in paying those wages?
No, it's a private company. Oh. They're entitled to privacy. Right. In terms of Sheffield Wednesday, I think it is fairly well known that the club has had financial challenges for a period of time, in terms of money sloshing around. So, you know, they sold the ground to a company called Sheffield 3 or Sheffield 4 Limited that didn't actually pay any cash for the ground. It's paying in installments. And at the same time, the club is repaying a loan to the owner. So it appears that the money from Sheffield 3 is then used to pay the owner back an installment of his money, and the owner just happens to own Sheffield 3. So we've got this sort of washing machine cycle of money flowing around, perfectly legal. Yeah.
Thank you to everyone who has supported the pod by becoming a Patreon, including Michael Morton, Ben Harrison and Tim Evely, or as I know him, Big Tim or Lovely Tim, Palace fan. If you'd like to join them by making a small monthly contribution to our always free-to-air podcast, then go to patreon.com/priceoffootball, and we will be back on Monday, the 26th of July, with a questions pod. And if you have any questions for us for that, it's questions@priceoffootball.com. Because, Kieran, we're taking our first break since October 2019. We will miss you. If you miss us, producer guy suggests, for reasons that I can only assume are financial, that you can listen to the 170 episodes that are still available that we've made. I'm not entirely sure you'd have time to, because I'm not sure even you, Kieran, would suggest to the Baron, I'm sorry, darling, I've just got to listen to every single pod we've ever done for the next 2 weeks. But we hope you have a good summer. If you're an England fan, we hope it's a happy celebratory one. And if you're an Italian fan, well, we hope you have a happy celebratory one too. We're all about the inclusion on this pod. We're football fans together. And I shall hand you over I'm getting quite emotional, Kieran. We're only going away for 2 weeks. please come back. Please come back, everybody, in 2 weeks. I'll hand you over to Kieran for his customary farewell.
Well, thanks again, folks, for all the feedback. We do take notice. We're always trying to improve the show as best we can. If you can press follow on that big Apple icon or Spotify or whoever you use, it makes a difference to producer guy.
Where that came from. He doesn't commute. He wouldn't know what a commuter was. There's no gold.
That's what his butler does.
Yeah, of course. His butler gets on the gold tram that stops at the special gold. He lives in Manchester, everybody. That's why this tram reference. He doesn't live in the past.
it makes a difference in terms of where we are in the ratings, in the tables, and we do try to pitch in to get guests, and one of the first things that they do, especially if they've not heard of the show, they look to see where we are. And apart from that, have a good break. I'm teaching in New York and Hong Kong for the next 2 weeks, but I have been told by a producer guy, if there's a big story breaking, would the team get back together again for a special emergency podcast? And of course, if the bat cave is needed, it will be there.
Yeah, and if push comes to shove, me and the Baroness will do a pod. Your ears will be burning then.
Yeah, mango flavored podcast from Manscaped to mango, eh?
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
The Price of Football. The price of football.